From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, living on the front lines of the abortion wars, we talk with journalist Eyal Press. His new memoir, Absolute Convictions, is about his father, an OBGYN who provides abortions as part of his practice in Buffalo. In the 80s and 90s, he was the target of protests and death threats. His colleague, Dr. Barnett Slepian, was murdered by an anti-abortion extremist in 1998. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Michael Kazin's new biography of William Jennings Bryan, the reform politician and anti-evolutionist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the son of an abortion provider who has been the target of protests and death threats, my guest A.L. Press is a close observer of the abortion wars. Press is a journalist who's a regular contributor to The Nation. He tries to understand both sides in his new book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America. The city is Buffalo, New York, where Press's family moved from Israel in 1973, just a few weeks after the Supreme Court legalized abortion. Press's father is an obstetrician and gynecologist who performs abortions as part of his practice. You may remember that another abortion provider in Buffalo was murdered by an anti-abortion extremist in 1998. That doctor, Barnett Slepian, was a friend and colleague of Press's father. In fact, Slepian used to fill in for Press's father, delivering his patients' babies every third weekend of the month. I asked A.L. Press to describe how Dr. Slepian was murdered.
Well, Dr. Slepian, it was a Friday night. He attended a memorial service commemorating the death of his father. He went to Temple. He came home that night with his wife, Lynn. His four boys were at home. And Dr. Slepian was standing in his kitchen. He had just put a bowl of split pea soup in the microwave oven. And suddenly there was a pop. And he turned to his wife and said, "Lynn, I think they've shot me." And then he collapsed to the floor in a pool of blood and was pronounced dead shortly thereafter.
And what was his relationship to your father?
He was a colleague, a professional colleague. The Buffalo is a city where the community of OBGYNs is small enough that people know one another. And by the 90s, they had been covering for each other on weekends doing deliveries. And that's an interesting thing in that both my father and Barnett Slepian were targeted by protesters for years because they performed abortions. Both of them also had regular gynecological practices. And my father, when I was growing up, what I knew him to be doing and his profession was delivering babies, because that's why he always left and you know, why he was always gone for the weekend and so forth. So it was a connection, a professional connection and a collegial one. And then, of course, they had a bond in that they both found themselves embroiled in the middle of the very fierce protests that broke out in Buffalo starting in the late 1980s.
How did your family find out that Dr. Slepian had been murdered?
They found out when an officer from the very first thing was a phone call from someone who worked at my father's office telling him that she had seen the news and that Dr. Slepian had been shot. When my father first heard it, he, in disbelief, thought she was joking, and he couldn't quite let it sink in. Then the doorbell rang. There was an officer from the Amherst police there, and of course he was there for two reasons, both to tell them what had happened and also to make sure that they pulled down the blinds and that they were very careful that that there wouldn't be two attacks that night. And so after that, they, still in a sort of state of shock, made their way to the hospital. And by the time they got there, Dr. Slepian had been pronounced dead.
When Dr. Slepian was murdered, did your father think, "I'd better stop performing abortions myself? This is just too dangerous"?
Well, others thought that. I found out about the murder the morning after, and like my parents, sort of just felt just this shock, this kind of surreal feeling. Then I flew to Buffalo a couple of days later, and during this period, we had lots of friends and colleagues and people who knew us calling and saying, "Look, this has just reached a point where you have to stop." My mother, who had always supported what my father did, never wavering, she felt he should stop. And I, very reluctantly, grappling with what it would mean to actually tell my father to do something he probably believed was wrong, also felt that his safety was the most important thing to me right then. But I both wanted this and knew that very likely, because of who my father is, the murder would not have that effect. And indeed it didn't. My father came to Buffalo from Israel. That's where he grew up and was raised. And he was ingrained in him was a very strong belief that people should do what they believe is right, regardless of the risks and the sacrifices that that entails, particularly in the face of a threat. And, you know, that's obviously a very deeply ingrained sort of national and Israeli mentality. And he carried that with him to Buffalo. And when the murder happened, I think his resolve only deepened.
Well, let me ask you to read a letter that a friend of your parents wrote after the murder of Dr. Salepian.
A few days after the murder, the murder of Dr. Salepian, I flew to Buffalo and I met my mother at the airport. When I got in the car, she burst into tears, and I could just feel the weight of the circumstances and the fear she was feeling. And she told me that that someone had called her and told her, you know, look, get him to stop, get your husband to stop putting himself in the line of danger. Then later that day, I was home. My mother had gotten the mail, and she opened a letter from a friend of the family's named George Schillinger. George, like my father, was a physician. Like my mother, he was a Holocaust survivor. And I was sitting upstairs on the floor. My mother said, I want to read this letter to you, and here it is. Dear Shalom, undoubtedly, I'm not the only one who calls you or writes to you expressing concern about your safety, but I am one who survived Bergen-Belsen, Russian jail, etc., and therefore have the right to say that survival is the utmost duty, one that supersedes every idea, principle, even pride. Please save your family from the potential horror that visited the Salepians.
What was your parents' reaction to this? I mean, what, you know, survival is the ultimate duty. This coming from someone who's a Holocaust survivor and survivor of a Soviet camp. I mean, how did they react to the letter?
Well, my mother reacted very emotionally. She herself, as I describe in the book, has an extraordinary story. She is the daughter of Holocaust survivors who were transported from Romania to Transnistria, where the Jews of Romania were taken. The majority of them died within a very short period. My grandparents survived, and miraculously, my mother was born in a sort of deportation work camp in 1942 and somehow made it through the war with her parents, came out of this, and came out very much with the mentality and the belief system that George Schillinger expressed in this very powerful letter that he sent. So needless to say, my mother didn't even have to say so. I knew that the letter was an expression of what she felt at that moment. For me, there was, I felt divided because that's one side of my family. The other side of my family is the Israeli side. I myself was born in Israel, and I suppose I'm very much my father's son in that I have a certain amount of the same kind of determination and belief that fear and threats and so forth should not deter people from doing what they believe is right. And so I felt very torn and conflicted.
Did your parents quarrel about whether your father should continue to perform abortions?
They might have quarreled if it had gone on much longer. There was a sort of disquieting tension, I would say, and again, I was in the middle of it. What ended up happening is a few days after the murder, we got a phone call, and the phone rang. My mother picked it up. She said, "Death threat? Death threat?" And sort of in disbelief, I watched her slump to the ground, and she handed me the phone. And on the line was an officer from the Amherst police, and he told me that they had learned of a threat that was given to a paper in Hamilton, Ontario, saying my father was next on the list. And that was sort of the peak of the tensions. But then after that happened, the police pretty much were a presence around our home 24 hours a day. And soon thereafter, my father fell under federal marshal protection. And that served to diffuse that kind of initial tension. And it also helped, I think, all of us kind of overcome the initial shock, the initial fear, and put what was happening in perspective.
What was it like for you as a high school student to suddenly have, you know, marshals and cops surrounding your house?
Well, actually, by this point, I was out of high school.
Good point. Okay, you were in college already and living there?
No, I had finished college. I was living in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. I was starting out my career as a journalist. But during that period, I spent a lot of time in Buffalo, just coming home. I felt I needed to be there to support my parents, and I wanted to be there. It was a very strange thing. I came into the house, and I wasn't sure if it was a house or a fortress. You know, I wasn't sure if it was their house anymore. And it was very strange to see my father, this very proudly independent person, being kind of followed around and protected in this way. And it really prompted for me some of the questions that I think led me to write this book, in particular. Both the murder and the kind of aftermath made me want to know why in America has this conflict, why had it become so polarized and embattled as to reach the point where doctors were hiring armed guards, you know, to work at their offices and so forth, and why only here has abortion remained so polarizing for so long. And then, of course, I wanted to understand why my father had a place in the story.
My guest is Eyal Press. His new book is called Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Eyal Press, and he's written a new memoir about his father and about the abortion controversy. His father is a gynecologist who also performs abortions in Buffalo, New York. And Dr. Slepian, the doctor who was murdered because he performed abortions, was a close friend and associate of Eyal Press's father. Press's memoir is called Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America. Now, you were mentioning that, you know, you wrote this book in part to figure out why is America so polarized about abortion, more polarized than other countries. Your father was born in Israel, and you point out that when your father moved to the United States to continue his medical studies in 1973, abortion had just been legalized here, but it was still illegal in Israel and remained illegal till around 1977. But you say that the illegality of abortion in Israel had more to do with demographics than with ethics. Would you explain?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was very important in shaping my father's views about abortion, which I would describe as pragmatic more than ideological. I mean, he views abortion as a medical procedure for which there is a demand and a need born of the reality of unplanned pregnancies. And that's something he witnessed in Israel because abortion there was indeed illegal. Illegal not because there was a sort of equivalent of the religious right saying this was murder, but because there was a desire to expand the population as much as possible and this sort of demographic push. But nevertheless, even though it was illegal, it was an open secret that abortions happened and that when unplanned pregnancies happened, women came to see doctors and that it was routinely performed. And so this kind of shaped my father's pragmatism on the issue. He felt then, and I still feels to this day, that as a society, we should do everything possible to minimize the occurrence of unplanned pregnancies. He believes very strongly that, educating people about the consequences of sex and contraception and so forth. But he also saw, both in Buffalo and in Israel, that the women who showed up to have for pregnancy terminations were an incredible cross-section of the society.
Did your father ever have any moral, ethical, religious objections to abortion?
I don't think he had any religious objections to abortion. Like many Jews, he believed that there is a distinction between the various phases of pregnancy, and that was also a view shaped by his medical practice and his interacting with patients. He does not perform late-term abortions. And, I think that he believes in an ideal world both that abortion should be something that's performed in the early stages of pregnancy and made as rare as possible by, through education and the use of contraception.
Now, your father has lived in and practiced medicine in Buffalo since 1973. Buffalo became one of the centers of anti-abortion protests. Why did Buffalo become a center?
Well, it's an interesting story because on the surface, the easy answer is here's this heavily Catholic city, and in the 70s, of course, the Right to Life movement was almost exclusively Catholic. So I kind of grew up, and when I started seeing the protests when I was in high school, I just assumed, well, it's a heavily Catholic city, that's why we're seeing this. It turns out the answer is much more complicated. The protests in Buffalo, as in so many places, started in the mid to late 80s, and they were led by many born-again Christians who entered the Right to Life movement in the mid-80s and radicalized it. And there was Randall Terry, who started Operation Rescue in nearby Binghamton. And there were a number of born-again ministers in Buffalo who got involved and started using the same tactics, this sort of civil disobedience, and these massive protests developed. So the irony of Buffalo is that when the movement is almost exclusively Catholic, it's not getting a lot of press. It's not, landing on the front pages of the Buffalo News and the headlines. When it becomes a more diverse movement and multi-denominational one, that's when it gets really hot.
Now, your father has mostly had a private practice, and he's, had a private office. When did his office become a target of protesters?
It started in 1987, and this again was when I was in high school. And one day, there was a mock funeral performed outside his office, and it sort of quickly spiraled from there. He initially thought there would be one such thing. A few months later, there was a rescue where people occupied the office, and then this kind of became a regular presence and a regular possibility. And again, like many people, I think he was kind of blindsided by it, perhaps more so than others, because he came to Buffalo not really understanding the politics of the issue. Although I think a lot of people in Buffalo were caught by surprise, both at the intensity of the protests and the longevity.
You mentioned the first protest in front of your father's office was a mock funeral. What was it?
It was literally protesters with caskets and the remains of what they claimed were babies who had been aborted at my father's office, some of whom were, it was claimed, found in a dumpster. My father and a spokesperson from my father's office denied that. They never disposed of fetal remains that way, and indeed it was not legal to do so. But nevertheless, the event was covered in the news, and it began a kind of spiral of protests.
Yeah, and what are some of the other forms those protests took in front of your father's office?
Well, the most common thing in the movement in Buffalo, both there and nationally, were rescues. And these were events where protesters would clasp hands and either try to block the entrance to an abortion clinic or a doctor's office, or on occasion they would enter and occupy a waiting room or something like this to try to prevent the women who had appointments that day from entering, and thus rescuing the unborn babies who would otherwise have been aborted. And this became the kind of signature expression of the Right to Life movement in the late 80s and 90s.
There were your father had protection at his house after Dr. Slepian was murdered. Was there any protection for the women who were coming to your father's office for abortions?
No, not that I know of. And I think if there's anything that strengthened my father's belief in continuing to serve as an abortion provider the most, it's seeing his patients kind of run the gauntlet of protesters and come in and often feel very shaken, sometimes they came in with tears, sometimes they were angry, and this really affected him. And it affected him not because he believes that the decision to have an abortion is an easy one. In fact, he's seen up close, more than most people, that the decision is often a very, very difficult one, a conflicted one, an emotional one for a woman. And precisely because of that, to see patients come in, to see women come in so shaken and upset, really had an effect on him.
Eyal Press is the author of the new book, Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at FordFound.org. And from Warner Home Video, announcing the 2-disc special edition DVD of Network, featuring a documentary on the making of the film. Available now. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Michael Kazin's new biography of William Jennings Bryan, who's best known for arguing against Clarence Darrow during the 1925 Scopes trial. And we continue our conversation with Eyal Press. He was in high school when his father became a target of anti-abortion protesters. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Eyal Press. His new book, Absolute Convictions, is about the abortion conflict from his perspective as the son of an OBGYN. Press's father provides abortions as part of his practice in Buffalo, New York, and has been the target of protests and death threats. Press's family moved to Buffalo from Israel in 1973. One of the kinds of slogans that was used by anti-abortion protesters was, comparing abortion to the Holocaust and to genocide. Your mother, as you mentioned, was a Holocaust survivor. She was actually born in a deportation camp. What was your mother's reaction to having the work that her husband did be compared to genocide and the Holocaust?
It was very difficult, and it was particularly difficult, I think, during the 1992 Spring of Life, which was a major national series of blockades that took place in Buffalo. This after the mayor of Buffalo, Jimmy Griffin, who was a very pro-life Catholic, welcomed Operation Rescue into town. And during the Spring of Life, on Holocaust Remembrance Day, there was a protest, and my father and Dr. Slepian, both of whom are Jewish, were named. And that was very, very difficult for my mother. She's like my father, a stoic person, a very strong person, and tough. But it carried a sting. I mean, she, her own family had survived this, and so needless to say, it really did carry a sting.
You were in high school when your father's practice became the target of anti-abortion protesters. What impact did that have on you? I mean, and did people, were you the subject of controversy among your classmates after that?
No, I wasn't. But, you know, that's an interesting thing. I did my best to ignore the whole issue. And I think that reflects, to a large degree, the sense of discomfort, embarrassment, maybe even shame that kind of rubbed off on me. I mean, I saw the protests and understood just how emotional and how fierce the beliefs around abortion were. And so it was something I didn't want to talk about. I didn't mention it to my friends. I became a journalist after graduating from college. Abortion was not something I ever wrote about. I didn't want to touch it. And I just felt, you know, why explore something that seems so fiercely polarized and so divisive. The murder of Dr. Slepian changed that, in that I felt I needed to understand the events and the forces that coalesced to produce such a thing. And I think I also came to feel that, you know, even though the issue is so polarized, the more I read about it, the more I learned that for the majority of Americans, the vast majority indeed, they don't fall on the extreme ends on either side of the abortion debate. Most people have more ambiguous feelings. They maybe believe abortion should be legal but restricted in certain ways. That's also true of the majority of people in Buffalo. And my book is an effort to engage that sort of middle of America that is the majority of America.
Well, when you were in high school, how much did you observe firsthand the protests at your father's practice? Did you go there much? Did he try to protect you from it and keep you away from his office?
I think he did try to protect me from it. He didn't want it to bother me. He didn't want me to see it, but I did see it. I saw the protesters with the signs driving by. I saw murderer, baby killer. I saw protesters on our sidewalk outside our home. One evening I remember shooting baskets and looking over, and I saw people praying and singing. And, you know, so a certain amount of not interaction, just I was aware of what was happening. It was, of course, only after starting to write the book that I actually met and spoke with some of the protesters.
What was that like? You spoke to protesters who were actually in front of your father's office?
Yes. In fact, in the book, there are various protesters I speak with, and several of whom took part in various actions, whether it was sidewalk counseling or rescues, getting arrested. It was intense to meet them, and I would say it was educational. It forced me to confront some of my own assumptions about the protesters. Growing up, my image of them was of sort of angry white males holding aloft their signs and insisting that their morality is imposed on everyone else, this sort of very familiar stereotype. many of the activists I ended up meeting were women. There was a woman, Mickey Vandeven, who is a sidewalk counselor in Buffalo and is among the more soft-spoken people I've met. It's hard for me to imagine her trying to impose her morality on others. I also met Karen Swallow Pryor, who was the spokeswoman for Operation Rescue for several years in Buffalo. She's now a professor of literature at Liberty University, which is Jerry Falwell's school. And when I went to meet Karen to speak with her, I came with lots of assumptions. I assumed I would be meeting a religious zealot who would quote the Bible to me. And I walked into her office and I saw literature anthologies lining the bookshelves. Classical music was playing. I see this very relaxed person who wants to engage me in dialogue. And it really struck me that I had come to the meeting with the very assumptions that I had, growing up, assumed only the other side had.
Do you think that the people you're referring to have changed since they were protesting in front of your father's office? Do you think that they have become less confrontational in their approach to their thinking about abortion?
I think in some cases, yes. In Karen Swallow Pryor's case, for example, she was profiled in, I believe, 1992 in the Buffalo News. And at the time, she said that she believed in the tactic of what were called house calls. These were protests in front of doctors' homes, sort of taking the protests right into the most personal private space of a physician. And she endorsed that tactic in that article. By the time I met with her, she had reconsidered that and decided that it was the wrong message to send. It was not something she would do. And indeed, Karen Swallow Pryor has, in the years since, engaged in many common ground dialogues in which she has searched out, I think very admirably, efforts to reach common ground with pro-choice people about how to limit the number of unplanned pregnancies and unwanted pregnancies, to limit the number of abortions that are performed, which I was very interested to learn, and which, again, I think is very admirable.
My guest is A.L. Press. His new book is called Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist A.L. Press. His new memoir is called Absolute Convictions, My Father, a City, and the Conflict That Divided America. The conflict he's referring to is the conflict over abortion. His father is an OBGYN who performs abortions as well, and his father's office was the target of many protests in the 80s and 90s. His father's friend and associate, Dr. Slepian, was murdered by an anti-abortion extremist. You've said that you wrote this book in part to understand the forces that produced the kind of extremists that an example of which is the person who murdered your father's friend, Dr. Barnett Slepian. And you went to the murderer's trial in, was it 2003?
Yes.
And it was James Kopp. Did he plead guilty?
That's complicated. There was he admitted to doing the shooting. I don't think in his mind he was guilty of murder, because the way he described what he did in court was that he was acting to prevent murder. And I think what became very clear listening to Kopp in court was that he feels the law is upside down. That, you know, the wrong people are being put in jail, that the people who should be put in jail are those who not only perform abortions, but condone abortion and make abortion possible. It was a very intense experience listening to him. You got a sense of just how clear and coherent and absolute his views on this issue were.
What are some of the things you feel like you learned from attending this trial about the more extreme end, or the most extreme end, I should say, of the anti-abortion movement?
Well, I think, as in the case of any movement where there is a violent wing, the common assumption, and in some ways the desire, I think, of everyone, is to just write off violence as a product of craziness, that people who commit acts of violence are insane. The reality, I think, is more complicated than that, and in some ways more disturbing. I think that James Kopp, as in court, came across not as someone who was crazy, but as an intelligent man who, for whom the world was a very broken, very dark place, and who developed a kind of all-consuming obsession with abortion and with the plight of the unborn. And I have no doubt that that was a sincere obsession, a real obsession. But it created a very strange approach to the world, whereby on the one hand, this intense feeling for the unborn, on the other hand, an intense contempt for the living. So in court, for example, he likened the officers, the Amherst police and the FBI, to the Gestapo. And he talked a lot about Nazi Germany, almost as if America itself is a version of Nazi Germany because of abortion. You got this sense of just a worldview where doubt where doubt has been eliminated, and there's only one view that can be accepted.
You know, I think when I mentioned James Kopp, I described him as being from the extreme end of the anti-abortion movement. I'm wondering if it's fair to even describe him as being a part of the anti-abortion movement. Is he perhaps just like a lone wolf extremist who identifies with the movement but wouldn't be embraced even by the extreme end of it?
Well, there's no doubt that I met various right-to-life activists, including Rob Shank, a minister who led the rescues in Buffalo, who described James Kopp as an imposter, as someone who does not belong in the movement, does not represent the movement, and does not share his pro-life views. And various other right-to-life activists I met said the same thing, that, you know, no one who harms someone who commits an act of murder can call themselves pro-life. On the other hand, the wing of the movement that embraced violence grew out of Operation Rescue. There was a sort of militant core that came to feel that, look, if we are going to equate abortion with murder and sanction breaking the law to stop it, at what point do you stop? And so the supporters of James Kopp would say that the imposters are the people who don't go as far as he went. Now, in terms of Kopp himself, I think he was very secretive about what he did. I think in some ways he fits the stereotype of the kind of lone wolf. I also spoke to various law enforcement people who believe that, you know, he got help in different ways, and whether the people helping him knew what he was actually up to, that's not so clear.
Your father, who's an OBGYN, has continued to perform abortions through all the protests, through the murder of his associate, Dr. Slepian. Are there still protests in front of his practice?
There are protesters. I wouldn't describe them as protests in the sense that the protests occurred in the late 80s and early 90s, where you had massive numbers of people. There are individuals who come on certain days. The large-scale protests stopped to a large extent after Congress passed and President Clinton signed the FACE law, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances law, in 1994. And that pretty much put an end to the rescue movement. It made it a federal crime to blockade a building. Now, at the time, I thought, well, okay, so it's over. Of course, it doesn't. It's not so simple. And what the FACE law did was further convince the more militant members of the movement that the only answer was violence. Although I should also say that we've moved along since then, and there's been a lull in the violence as the focus has shifted to Washington.
And to the courts.
And to the courts, yes.
Your father is near retirement. Do you think that there is a doctor who will replace him when your father retires and take over the abortion part of the practice? In other words, will there be somebody else providing abortions in that part of Buffalo when your father retires?
There will be abortion providers in Buffalo when my father retires. As I said, the clinic where Dr. Salepian worked is still open. There are other doctors in the nearby area who perform abortions. There's the place in Niagara Falls. What there isn't, increasingly, are doctors who set up a regular OBGYN practice and include abortion as part of that practice, which is what my father did. He never did abortions exclusively. And he just thought of this as one of many medical procedures that he would perform. And that is increasingly rare. And it's increasingly rare because people now, unlike when he was starting out in the mid-70s, people now are so aware of the controversy that comes with it, that you increasingly have abortion isolated into these clinics and into a kind of corner of the medical world.
We've talked a little bit about the religious and ethical views held by anti-abortion protesters, some of whom protested at your father's medical practice. What are some of the things you learned about the politics of the anti-abortion movement?
I think the politics are fascinating and they're central to my story, as there were some conservative strategists who realized that one way to bring a new constituency of working class Catholics and white ethnics and evangelicals into the conservative movement was to address the social issues, the cultural issues, and abortion was prominent among them. That doesn't mean that the people in the Right to Life movement, that their feelings weren't sincere. It's more that the people who were sort of thinking strategically felt, well, let's look at what the Republican Party's platform is on abortion, change it, and integrate this new constituency into it. And in the book, I describe how that played a central role in the emergence of this new form of conservative populism, where cultural issues rather than class issues were center. And I think that's very much the case in our politics today. It was the case in Buffalo, this working class city, where you had tremendous inequality and a lot of factories left the city throughout the 70s, and yet out of that emerges this kind of cultural populism and not a sort of class movements.
Well, A.L. Press, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
A.L. Press is the author of the new book, Absolute Convictions. You can find an excerpt of his book and listen to NPR's 1998 coverage of Dr. Barnett Slepian's murder on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of William Jennings Bryan, best known for making the case against evolution in the Scopes trial. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. William Jennings Bryan has been fixed in the popular memory as the fundamentalist anti-evolution heavy in the 1925 Scopes trial. But according to historian Michael Kazin, Bryan was a provocative combination of lay preacher and reform politician. Kazin's new book, A Godly Hero, is the first major biography of Bryan to appear in almost 40 years. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In one of those coincidences that sometimes strikes in the random universe of literature, I just finished teaching some essays by H.L. Mencken when I picked up Michael Kazin's new biography of William Jennings Bryan called A Godly Hero. Among Mencken's most scorching essays are those in which he chronicles the 1925 Scopes trial, where Bryan argued for the prosecution against the teaching of evolution in public schools, more in fear of social Darwinism, as Kazin describes it, than in support of biblical literalism. Mencken never had much affection for ordinary Americans, and his contempt runneth over as he reviled Scopes' critics, whom he saw as ignorant Bible thumpers, and their spokesperson, Bryan. Mencken spat out this verdict on Bryan. He seemed only a poor clod like those around him, deluded by a childish theology, full of an almost pathological hatred of all learning, all human dignity, all beauty, all fine and noble things. He was a peasant come home to the barnyard. Bryan died 5 days after the Scopes trial ended, and Mencken's withering words have pretty much constituted Bryan's epitaph for scholars of the left ever since. But conservatives have also been queasy about embracing Bryan as one of their movement's political forerunners. After all, Bryan was a champion of labor unions and argued for expanding the powers of the federal government to combat the evils of big business. Biographer Kazin has confessed in a recent article in Dissent magazine that even he feels ambivalent about his hard-to-categorize biographical subject, who drew on both Jesus and Jefferson for political guidance. Bryan was a sunny populist, dubbed the Great Commoner, who captured the adoration of millions of Americans, yet lost his campaigns for the presidency 3 times. He was an anti-modernist, teetotaling son of the heartland, who nonetheless fought for women's suffrage. He was a titanic defender of the working man, whose great flaw, as Kazin succinctly puts it, was that he could never extend his lifelong faith in the people to black Americans, most of whom worked at decidedly common jobs. Perhaps ambivalence rather than adoration is a good stance for a biographer to adopt, at least it is in this case, because A Godly Hero is an extraordinarily rich and revealing work. A biography of one of the most crucial Americans never to win a presidential election, it also doubles as a fascinating one-volume history of America prior to and during the great age of reform that spanned the end of the 19th century and the first 2 decades of the 20th. In rescuing Bryan from the strangling legacy of the Scopes trial, Kazin deftly separates out the often contradictory but always dramatic storylines of Bryan's epic political career, a career that transformed the Democratic Party and laid the groundwork for FDR's New Deal. I'll just mention 2 key moments that Kazin illuminates. The first is one of Bryan's legendary speeches, delivered without notes on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1893, when Bryan was serving as a young congressman from Nebraska. In about the 3rd hour of this speech, which was a call to moral combat against the gold standard and the forces of laissez-faire capitalism, Bryan thundered like an Old Testament prophet. "The poor man," he said, "is called a socialist if he believes that the wealth of the rich should be divided among the poor. But the rich man is called a financier if he devises a plan by which the pittance of the poor can be converted to his use." With that kind of rhetoric, which, by the way, earned Bryan a standing ovation in the House that day, you'd think that the famed socialist journalist John Reed would have fallen down and worshipped Bryan in 1916 when he interviewed him for Collier's Weekly. Not so. Reed sneered at Bryan in the story he eventually wrote, and as Kazin carefully describes it, Reed's sneer marks a key transition in the history of the American left. It was the sneer of the urban, secular modernist directed at the pious populist crusader. It was a sneer that, as Kazin points out, would soon render the idea of a political movement of the Christian left, which Brian embodied, history. One of the greatest services a historian can perform for readers is to remind us that what's accepted as the norm today was not ever so. In a nation where, as Kazin shows us in this deeply perceptive work, democratic values often intertwine with religious faith, our own sneers at this remarkable American and his flock betray a self-defeating smugness.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the memoir Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed A Godly Hero, The Life of William Jennings Bryan by Michael Kazin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. And from Jane and Gerald Catcher for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rapper and actor Mos Def. He co-stars in the new film 16 Blocks. And we listen back to an interview with science fiction writer Octavia Butler. She died last Friday at the age of 58. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.